Russell Banks is the author of nearly 20 books. He's known for such best-selling novels as Continental Drift and those made into movies, Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter. He's also an avid traveler and cultural explorer, as recounted in his 2016 memoir, Voyager, Travel Writings. He reveals not just his inner and outer journeys, but also what's special about the U.S.
We are unique, really, on this planet as a culture, in as much as we are a truly Creolized culture.
More on that from Russell Banks ahead on New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This conversation was recorded at the 2018 Writers for Readers event. This annual benefit allows UMKC students in the Creative Writing and Media Arts program to teach with Literacy KC. Who better to inspire than this working-class New England writer, familiar with adversity, as you'll hear in this interview by his former student and now fellow novelist, Whitney Terrell. He begins their conversation with Russell Banks' recent memoir, Voyager.
Your first long essay in the book, Voyager, is structured around a trip that you made through the Caribbean with your, at that time, to-be wife, Chase Twitchell, in 1988. But the trip is a way of circling back on the past and sort of meditating on three prior marriages. And for me, reading it felt like circling back to the past as well, because in 1988, I was at Princeton, and I'm pretty sure I took a class from you that year. So that was a time of huge upheaval for you, As the essay really is very explicit about, but I had no idea at the time.
No, well, I didn't really want to reveal any of that to my students at the time.
So we had to find out 30 years later.
Yeah, the first sentence in that long essay, and it is long, I'm afraid, it's about 100 and some pages. The first sentence is, a man who has been married four times has a lot of explaining to do. And so the essay is an attempt to explain the three previous marriages and why he was still willing to continue on and plunge ahead yet again into this morass of marriage and try to make it good finally. And I will tell you today, Chase Twitchell and I are about to celebrate our 30th anniversary, so it did take.
Yay!
I finally got it right. But it's so amusing that you saw it as I would show up in class with this kind of equanimity, very organized, and now we're going
to
do this, we're going to do that. And meanwhile, I was going through this disastrous divorce and remarriage and terrible personal tumult and so forth, and managed not to reveal a bit of it.
Did you have to think about that before class, or was it just like, okay, I'm going to go teach. I got my own problems. It's not a deal that I'm going to bring to the classroom. Or were you like in the office composing yourself before you came in?
You know, I just always felt I was lucky that I wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict and that I wasn't dealing with my troubles
in
those ways, that in fact I could manage to compartmentalize my life sufficiently. And in fact, the essay itself, if you read it that way, you could see that one of the mental problems or barriers that this narrator has, which is, of course, myself, is his ability to compartmentalize. He compartmentalizes his experiences in such a way that they don't communicate very well with each other. And the struggle through the essay, in many ways, is an attempt to break down some of the walls between those compartments.
I mean, and that's where the title comes from, in part, right? It's named
Voyager.
After the Voyager.
Right. Is to somehow manage to break down those categories and those compartments, those boxes that we tend to live in and that we tend to, like, exclude from each other so there's no communication back and forth, and so that we never are able in some way to create a coherent narrative for ourselves. That great John A. Williams novel, Stoner, ends saying, I knew who I was and I knew who I had been. We never end up at that point as long as we keep boxing and compartmentalizing our lives. And so the essay is really an attempt, in fact, the whole book is really an attempt to try to break down those walls which had created, in many respects, the, I won't say disasters, but the problematic aspects of my life up to that point of those three previous marriages. If you've been married four times, you have three divorces, and that's not easy. And so,
well, you were so young, though. I mean, that very first marriage that you talk about, which I think you write about really eloquently, I mean, you were 19.
I was 19 years old. By the time I was 20 years old, I had been married and I had fathered a child and I was divorced. But, you know, I was the child of divorce. My parents had divorced when I was 12. My father had abandoned the family. He was a plumber. And suddenly my mother was a single parent with four children and my father had gone. And because I was the oldest, and my father had said as he left, "You're the man of the house now, Russell," I suddenly felt the need to repair this rent in our life, yeah. in our family life, in our psychic life, our emotional life. And I couldn't do it, of course. I was only 12 years old.
Right.
So I waited till I was 19 and then replicated it in a sense, as, yeah. as we do in life. And we tend to go through these compulsive repetitions of the trauma, of whatever the trauma was. And in this case, it surely was this abandonment by my father and the displacement, really, into that role of the male figure in the family as I had to undertake and fail at, inevitably.
There are some amazing scenes in the essay where you talk about watching your mother cry in the bathroom, I think,
yeah.
and learning that if you comforted her, she would cry longer. If
yeah.
you ignored her and were separate, she would cry less.
Yeah.
And like that was a bad lesson in a certain ways for you to learn, but
exactly.
a lesson that you learned at that time.
Exactly, yeah. That need for detachment and so forth, we got reinforced over and over in ways which one is never conscious of as you evolve, you know, as you're young and then become gradually middle-aged, and you're still not conscious of it. You're still acting out in so many ways.
Yeah.
So the book is, for me, an attempt to try to account for an evolution that took place without my really being able at the time to track it.
Yeah.
From trauma to healing and then growing in an existential way free as I got older and managed to do it. And I found that the trope or metaphor really of travel gave me access to this narrative. The book is really a travel book, I suppose, about any number of different voyages. The main one is the voyage of marriage and love, but it also is literalized and placed into a very physical context.
Yeah.
First the Caribbean and then West Africa and then Jamaica and Haiti and so on, and then Nepal, Tibet, and
right.
the Andes, climbing mountains and so on. But it uses these literal physical journeys as a way of talking about and unfolding for myself in the writing the journey of my own life. I could not have written the book, certainly, when I was younger. I mean, I wrote it when yeah. I was 76, 77. It's an old man's book, in a way.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't feel like that to
All
me.
All right, thank you.
That book is Voyager, Travel Writings by Russell Banks, published in 2016 by Echo. It sheds light on his early works, the 1978 Hamilton Stark and the 1981 Book of Jamaica, two of three novels re-released in 2008 under the title Outer Banks. Again, here's Whitney Terrell.
I want to talk about the Caribbean and Jamaica, which, you know, you're on a tour with Chase through all of the islands of the Caribbean, which is the sort of now of the story in the essay that we're discussing, the first essay in the book, Voyager. And Jamaica, in particular, is a place you've written about a lot and where you lived. And when I got into your class in 1988, one of the first things I did was buy this set of your early books, including
You're a
the
good
Book of
student,
Jamaica.
Whit.
I have Hamilton Stark also.
I never assigned those books. I never trusted teachers of writing who assigned their own
books. We were
books
talking
to
about this
student.
In class today.
I left saying, it up to you to find them on your
I
own.
I was saying yeah. to my students, look, I had class with these writers when I was in college, Russell and Joyce Carol Oates. And this is an exception. It took me a while to buy their books. You might want to try reading your writing professor's books now rather than 15 years later.
Yeah.
These were also reissued in the wake of Continental Drift, which came out in 1985 and was a hit. It's one of my favorite books of yours. The book is partly set in Haiti, which is just a little west of Jamaica and Cuba. And the Haitian characters in that novel immigrate to America as part of what came to be known as the Haitian boat people, which is a term that I don't like that much, in the late 70s, early 80s. Could you talk about that novel a little bit and how it may or may not have grown out of some of your early life Caribbean travels, which you outline in the essay Voyager?
Well, it's a kind of an odd story for me now to look back on because it was published in 1985, written in the first few years of the 80s. And Because it seems, in a way, unintentionally prescient about
yes,
our present circumstance.
Yes, that's the other thing I want to talk about.
It's a book read in Europe, for instance, as if it was really about Europe and the immigration
right.
into Europe from North Africa and from the Middle East today. And today read here as well as if it's about, you know, the migrants coming in from the south.
Well, just to set it up for people who may not have read it.
It's a two-pronged story.
There's Bob Dubois.
About a northern New England white man, an oil burner repair man who decides to remake his life. He's in his early 30s with his wife and two kids and decides he's going to go to Florida, to the Sun Belt, as we used to call it, to remake his life as a lot of people did, leaving the Rust Belt as it was forming, rust,
yeah.
in the early 80s. And so he heads south. And, you know, he does it on a margin, a very, very narrow margin economically. So he's soon forced to go deeper and deeper into debt just to survive. And told at the same time is a story of a Haitian woman and her brother and her little baby boy as they try to escape from the extraordinary poverty and oppression of life in Haiti in this same era and are willing to become boat people, to put their lives at enormous risk in the hands of people today we call coyotes, who are willing to transport them, smuggle them north into Florida. And so the two stories gradually come together. Thus the title, Continental Drift. The two stories eventually collide because the white American man becomes so financially desperate that he's willing not to indulge at the time, which was so popular for someone in his position, in smuggling drugs, but in smuggling people. So he ends up smuggling people, Haitians, as it turns out, north into the United States. And so their lives come together
yeah.
over that incident. And then there is a tragic incident where, of course, he ends up with enormous control and power over how they end up. That's the basic outline.
I mean,
of the story.
We did a fiction nonfiction podcast with Edwige Dantica, who's a writer that you
yes.
know,
yes.
a Haitian writer. You know, right after the president decided to call Haiti a shithole country, and it made me think of your novel because I think people forget how anti-immigrant sentiment was in the 80s when these Haitian people were arriving. I wonder if you could sort of talk about what that was like, because I don't think I was aware of it either.
It was more overt, perhaps, than it is today, except on the extreme right in America. I was sitting in the library in Concord, New Hampshire in the early 80s and doing some research, and I opened the New York Times, and there was a photograph in front of the New York Times of Haitian black bodies rolling up in the surf outside Fort Lauderdale. And the story was about an American captain who was smuggling them from the Bahamas, and he had been accosted by a Coast Guard boat, and he had pushed them off the boat,
oh my
just
God.
Off the shore. And like most island people, Haitians can't swim, and they ended up drowning and rolled in. And I was reading this thing, and I had spent enough time, as you mentioned, in living in the Caribbean, and I knew how someone would be so desperate and so blocked off from a possible future that they would put their lives in the hands of someone who would throw them into the sea. But I also knew at the same time, because I grew up in a working class world in the upper northeastern United States, I knew how somebody at that time could end up so deeply in debt and so frightened, so screwed up in his life, that he could end up saying, okay, I got a boat, I'll bring these people over for $200 a head, and it's no big deal, I can do this. And I can make a couple of $1,000, and I can pay my mortgage back, and I can pay the car loan back, and I can do this, and I can do that. And he would do it, but then he would get scared, and he'd be at that moment.
Yeah.
That was the thing that came out of this newspaper clipping, which was luminous for me. It was like, whoa, I know that story.
Wow.
I know that story so deeply. Because my family was that white guy. And I also know that black woman. I know that woman in Haiti or Jamaica or anywhere else you want to place her, whose life is just dead-ended, and she's 21 years old.
But that probably wouldn't have happened if you hadn't been living in those other countries, right? Do you think
that wouldn't have happened. Yeah. No.
That moment of inspiration is amazing. I've never heard you tell that story
before. No, I haven't told it much, but that is how it happened. I just had a read it. I said, oh, I was actually researching another novel, which I'm very happy to say I never wrote. It would have been a very boring novel about the relationship between Nathaniel Hawthorne and the 13th president of the United States, Franklin Pierce, who were college...
Yeah, that sounds like a thriller, Russell.
You don't want to read that
one. We might not have been sitting here if you'd written that one.
You're listening to Russell Banks at the 2018 Writers for Readers event at UMKC, where his former Princeton student now teaches. This is New Letters on the Air with Whitney Terrell.
I also teach an essay of yours called Who Will Tell the People on Waiting Still for the Great Creole American Novel. It came out in Harper's Magazine in 2000. I think, and you actually came here to Kansas City to speak about it. In that essay, you say, we have refused to tell ourselves a single believable story of our origins that will connect the Euro-American tale directly to the African-American to the Latino-American, and so on. I wonder if you could talk about this concept of what you call creolization, which you also discuss in Voyager, and then maybe we'd have you read a passage from Voyager that talks about that.
Mm-hmm. We tend to imagine American history the way we've learned it, which is an east-west story, or a west-east story, Europe to this North American continent, instead of a north-south story, when in fact our history is very different from the way it's been portrayed generally and the way certainly European history is unfolded. It's really a north-south story, I think. And yes, it's connected to Africa, it's connected to Europe, connected to Asia, and now increasingly South America as well. But we are unique, really, on this planet as a culture, in as much as we are a truly creolized culture. How are we ever going to explain ourselves to ourselves without jazz? How are we ever going to explain ourselves to ourselves without James Baldwin? How are we ever going to explain ourselves to ourselves about what it is to be human and American without Native Americans? We can't do that. We can't talk about this continent, its physicality, its mere presence. It's simple physical presence here in Kansas, here in Florida, here in upstate New York, wherever we are. How can we talk about that without accommodating the Native presence?
Yeah.
And yet we act as though it's irrelevant, or we have to such an extraordinary degree, act as though all those other presences have no real relevance. And so we sit around trying to rewrite the wasteland. but I mean, we're unable in some ways to kind of integrate all that.
Yeah.
We tend to break up into what Robert Creeley, the poet, called lost colonies of the saved because of the frustration and the difficulty of integrating all that into one, what I call Creole culture.
I love that term.
We have to abandon certain kind of claims on it, you know. We, meaning, you know, we, especially Euro-white people, anyone who wants to make a claim on the culture as a whole, you have to abandon it and say, no. Let's make a Creole culture. Like, let's let jazz be the model.
Yeah. Would you read some from this?
Yeah, sure. Despite the blocks of condo construction in and around Marigot and Grand Casse, and the spanking new resort hotels spreading along the north coast, Saint Martin in the intervening years had not changed significantly. Outside the towns, cattle grazed in the wide pale green valleys, and every farmyard kept its fattened geese, hens, ducks, and a well-fed pig loosely fenced, looking more like family pets than livestock. There was some spillage from the package tour crowd and the mania for development on the Saint Martin side, but the French half was still relatively sleepy and laid back, and except in downtown Marigot, uncrowded, rural. And still very French, which meant that when we struggled to speak French, the locals switched to bad English, and if we spoke English, they stuck to French and seemed not to understand us. This would turn out to be true in all the French islands, Saint Martin, Saint Barthélemy, Guadeloupe, and Martinique. But I was in a good mood, glad to be exactly where I happened to be, if a little agitated by the troubling overlay of freshly unlocked memories of my earlier visit with Christine, his previous wife, and the girls, his daughters. And I found the natives' perverse condescension somehow amusing, even endearing, as if it were a measure of their provincialism rather than mine. There were many traditional French restaurants in Grand Casse and Marigot, and the guidebooks listed them all. And in the interests of the magazine article I was supposed to be writing, we tried a few. But after one meal at a tiny, unlisted bistro called Bistro Nu, We instantly became regulars. It was tucked into a dark alley in Marigot, off Rue de Hollande, between Rue de la République and Rue de Galisbe. We stumbled into it one night by accident and returned again and again for the Creole food, of course, that syncretic mingle of French and African and Arawak Caribe cuisine with local produce, meat, and fish. And for the non-vintage Rhone wine, which was cheap, more than adequate, what we used to mean by decent house red. We returned for the friendly company of our fellow diners who were local folks, mostly black, enjoying a family night out, and for the nervous, earnest, young white Frenchman named Raoul, who acted as head waiter and busboy with a different posture and patter for each role. We went back for the blaf, the West Indian lime-marinated bouillabaisse, and the black boudin, and tiny octopuses called chatrou, and the lamb colombo, callaloo, and acra. And to wait for a glimpse of the Haitian chef and owner, also named Raoul, a sweating black behemoth who rose from the kitchen and back every half hour or so and came and stood at the swinging door and glared out at the diners as if we did not deserve his cooking. But something more kept drawing us back to Bistro New. It wasn't just the dim light and the 10 small square cloth-covered tables that reminded us of the perfect French neighborhood bistro, nor the old-style Caribbean building that housed the restaurant, a 100-year-old daub and wattle cabin with a steeply pitched tin roof and an unpainted door in the street and window shutters thrown open to the tropical night and the seaport darkness of the alley and the sounds of young couples talking in low voices as they strolled past. In some way, this generous, intelligent, humorous blend of the best of Europe, Africa, and Mesoamerica, this process called creolization, which we heard in the language and music and saw in the art and architecture and tasted in the food, was embodied in this tiny restaurant itself. Sometimes two people in midlife come together, and against all odds, their pasts suddenly mingle and blend as if they had once been young together, almost as if they had shared a childhood, like cousins or even siblings. And though they remember them differently, they remember the same things, especially the moods and atmospheres, the tone and coloration of the past. Bistro New was Chase's and my first shared, unspoken, romantic vision of the Caribbean. Bamba's surf shack back on Tortola, despite our initial attraction, was its opposite. For both of us, the little Saint-Martin bistro was based in a private, fondly remembered literary version of a Paris we had each visited separately long ago, when she was a teenage schoolgirl traveling with her schoolmasters, and 20 years later, when I, in my mid-30s, arrived in Paris, accompanied by my third wife, Becky, for the first publication of a book of mine in France. And now these private images were Chase's and mine together, regathered, blended, remade, creolized.
Russell Banks with his book Voyager, the 2016 memoir he's discussing with Whitney Terrell.
Thank you. That was beautiful. I know we got to wrap up, but I have a couple quick questions. Mm-hmm. Mountain climbing, Russell. What are you doing? Mountain climbing. A lot of things in this book I'm like, oh, I like that. The Alaska essay, I've been to Alaska. I like Alaska. Caribbean, like Caribbean, been there. Mountain climbing, not for me.
Well, I'm lucky my knees have held up, which yours are not showing great signs of doing, if I may say. But I do like mountain climbing, and I've been doing it for most of my adult life. Since I was in my late 20s, I started. And the last one was just this July. I climbed in the Peruvian Andes for 2 weeks, and I realized I had reached the end of it. I'm 78 years old, and I was at 15, 16,000 feet, and really had reached my limit. And we had two guides. I was with the four men I climb with and like and have traveled everywhere with in Tibet and Nepal and in the Andes and in Africa and so on. And the guides were these young super climbers. These are men who in May, they summit Everest without oxygen, and then they come and they take people like me up the mountains in the Andes, and something for them is just a stroll in the park. We sat down together one night when I had clearly reached my limits, and I said, listen, I'm really at the end of this. And they said, yeah, we know. And and I said, how many guys in their 70s are still out there doing this alpine climbing? And they said, Russell, no one. It's time to stop. And so I stopped. This was my last climb in July, yes. And
well, the book, you can read three different excellent essays about climbs now that Russell stopped climbing without worrying that he's doing it. One last question. We've talked about a lot of serious stuff.
Yes.
But once I got to see you read at Carnegie Hall, you invited me to come see you, and then you said, you want to come to dinner afterward? And I was like, sure. And I went to dinner, and at that dinner was Willem Dafoe, the producer of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, mm-hmm. and the composer John Adams, mm-hmm. and then me.
Right.
And you. And it was this amazing, you know, Hollywood dinner, and Dafoe was talking about making Continental Drift. Mm-hmm. And ever since Affliction was made into a movie and The Sweet Hereafter and those movies did so well, I know you've always had irons in the fire in Hollywood. So what are you up to these days in the movie business?
Well, I co-wrote the screenplay adaptation of one of my short stories called Snowbirds for the great French director Bertrand Tavernier. Some of you may know his work. The best known movie in the United States of his is Round Midnight, the great jazz movie. And so he's shooting this. It's mostly shot in Miami, and Amazon is doing that. Susan Sarandon and Jennifer Jason Leigh are playing the two leads. It's an interesting, complicated story about two women. And then the other thing is that Cloud Splitter, a novel about the abolitionist and terrorist,
John Brown.
Which
I'm glad you
bring
up. That's a fantastic book.
Fox FX is making that into an 8-part series.
Oh, my God,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And that's underway. And I'm attached as that easily dismissed
as
person.
As the guy who wrote the book.
It's the guy who wrote the book and executive producer, which doesn't
mean. Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm very involved in those two projects. And more interestingly to me in some ways, and perhaps more curious, is I'm writing a libretto for an opera, which I'm finding very exciting and really
interesting. You talk to John Adams about this?
No, it's with another composer named Robert Carl, and he's doing the music, and I'm writing the libretto. And I've never written a libretto before, but it's a very interesting, exciting proposition, and I love doing it. He's a brilliant musician, and for me, it's a fascinating and interesting story. It's not an adaptation. It's an original libretto, yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a foolhardy thing to be doing.
We'll find
out. Hey, guess what, Mom? I'm writing a libretto to an opera. Yeah.
At least you're not climbing a mountain. Nobody's going to tell you that you're too old to write a libretto.
That's a nice line. You're never too old to write a libretto.
There you go. Right? This is incredibly gratifying to have you here among my friends and family and community. So
thank you
for all you've given to literature in the world. And thank you for being here with us.
Well, thank you, too.
Russell Banks and fellow novelist Whitney Terrell, the co-host of the podcast Fiction Nonfiction. This interview was recorded at the November 2018 Writers for Readers annual benefit that allows for UMKC students to teach with Literacy KC. By the way, the world premiere of Russell Banks and Robert Carl's opera, Harmony, is scheduled for 2020. And if you want to prepare for his mini-series about John Brown, listen to our 1999 archive interview with Russell Banks about that historical novel, Cloud Splitter. It's on our website, newletters.org. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency, and from listeners like you. Look for the Support New Letters button in the top right-hand corner of newletters.org. You can follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and now Instagram. Today's show was produced with Robert Zimmerman, Mary Hinn, Amelia Romine, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.